In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
When it gets right down to it, it's amazing how much people fear freedom. Leading up to the vote to leave the EU, there was a lot of fear-mongering by the people in power over in Britain. The politicians, the banks, and the bureaucrats. You heard things like, if you leave the Union, there will be massive job losses, you'll lose your trading partners, you're basically committing suicide if you leave the EU. What you didn't hear these leaders saying was, the UK will be just fine because I have faith in the British people. If they leave, they will be just fine because they are fully capable of making their own way. You didn't hear that because the fear of the future is how so many old-school politicians stay in power. Back in the Middle Ages, peasants had no rights and had no means to be self-reliant. They depended on the ruling elite for nearly everything, and so they lived in relative slavery in exchange for relative safety. But as the merchant class grew, meaning businessmen, as the merchant class grew and business expanded, they grew in power and wealth, enough to challenge the ruling class. And as business expanded, they needed more workers, which led to expansions in education and skilled workers, and new ships and cannons and better technology, and on and on. And all of this raised the standard of living for everyone. Business and capitalism is at the heart of freedom because it allows you to create your own future. Our founding fathers recognized this, enshrining in our founding documents not only liberties and freedoms, but also the right to own property. Without private property, you would have no freedoms because they would all be dependent on the state, which would determine how far you could go in life. In America, you could be your own king. And that was the brilliance of the founding fathers. They recognized you couldn't be partly free. Freedom means freedom. So they enshrined the rights to pursue your own life as you see fit, protected your rights to worship as you see fit, to speak your own mind, to take a stand, and to defend yourself from others who seek to control you. In creating the government, they put handcuffs on it. And by that, they ensured not only freedom, but the chance to make your own future. We salute the people of Britain who chose freedom, who chose independence and the right of self-determination. On today's show, it is all about freedom. It is our annual 4th of July show, and for that I'd like to welcome Greg Leo, our annual guest for these. Greg is a political and business consultant in his day job, but one of his real passions is history and especially the 4th of July. Greg, it's always great to talk to you for these.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be on the show today.
Well, I thought in this first segment we'd start with kind of an introduction about the July 4th and sort of a recap maybe from last year. You know, the celebration of July 4th, this was such a momentous break that it represented. There were some similarities, I think, to the English Civil War, but was there ever really another instance where a colony had thrown off its monarchy to gain full independence and freedom?
No, this was a first, and it shook the entire world. As we know, at Yorktown, when Cornwallis surrendered to General Washington, they played "The World Turned Upside Down," and it truly was. This was the first real revolution that we had had.
Our founding fathers were obviously and keenly aware of history, and 100 years before the American Revolution, a little bit more, about 120 years, there was the English Civil War where they had rebelled against King Charles I, and that culminated with his execution in 1649. You had the House of Commons, they abolished the monarchy, and the House of Lords was also abolished, and they installed a commonwealth. Effectively, this was a republic, but it failed after only about 10 years. What lessons do you think our founding fathers took away from that experiment with republicanism?
Well, that, you know, as a new nation and as a land that accepted people from all over the world, it really was not a good place to have a monarchy. Hmm. The monarchy was seen as rigid and really kind of brittle, whereas people were used to self-government. I mean, the mostly agrarian colonies, there were not a lot of big cities. There's not a lot of organization. People basically bonded together for their common defense, and they made public decisions in the town square, and that was the American tradition. Very different than the medieval system that grew into the monarchy with the aristocracy there in England. So quite different, and we grew in a different direction.
Why do you suspect that that Commonwealth, which was a republic, why do you suspect that that failed so spectacularly? I mean, like I said, it didn't even last 10 years.
It didn't meet the needs of the people, and the whole system was built on, you know, aristocracy owning the land and the people paying the aristocracy, the king then demanding money from that aristocracy to run the country. And so it was really a very top-down kind of government instead of the bottom-up kind of government that we have in our republic.
Hmm. One of the things that I thought was interesting, too, from that experiment in the instrument of government that they passed, the parliament did, it granted executive power to the Lord Protector, and it was sort of like a presidency in a way. It was technically elective and wasn't strictly hereditary, but it was to be held for life. So it was sort of like they had replaced one monarchy with another one.
Well, and George Washington had that same decision to make after the American Revolution, where there were many people who said that he should be king of America. And Washington said, well, wait a second, that isn't what we fought for. We fought for, you know, states banding together into these United States, and for there not to be a monarch, but rather to be a elected Congress and a president who was elected every 4 years to bring things together. And so, you know, America is a unique and wonderful idea. I think the founding fathers did a pretty good job, which now 240 years later seems to be doing just fine.
Yeah. Well, we certainly have had our ups and downs. Last year, we had we talked about the importance of 4th of July celebrations as America expanded west. We had Indiana, which was the West for a while, and where someone managed to shoot their arm off while loading a cannon for the 4th of July. But then we also talked about some of the huge picnics there at Independence Rock, and you can go through some of the Pioneer Diaries, and they talked about just a huge celebration that they had. And what really impressed me about our discussions last year was how very similar a lot of the 4th of July celebrations were then as they are to today, except maybe whole shooting off an arm with a cannon part.
Yeah, right from the beginning, it was a time for parades, for barbecues, for speeches, for public gatherings, and to shoot off pyrotechnics. It, you know, right from the beginning, it was about celebrations that were loud, that were popular, and that were a lot of fun. So, you know, really, even in 1777, the first big celebration in Philadelphia and in Boston all used fireworks and really were very much like the celebrations Americans have today.
Yeah. It's 240 years. Did our founding fathers actually think it would last this long? And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're celebrating the 4th of July this weekend, and to do that, we're talking with Greg Leo. He is our regular guest for our 4th of July shows. Always a fun time with Greg, and you know, one of the things that we probably should have talked about is why do we celebrate the 4th of July and not the Constitution, which is really the embodiment of our freedoms?
Where some of us do celebrate Constitution Day, which is September 19th. In fact, this year we're having an excellent event at Shampooig Park at historic Newell Village, where we're having a federal judge come and talk about the Constitution, how important it is. But the main reason for celebrating independence is our freedom, that this is where the basic doctrine of American freedom was established. And this is the freedom to have self-government, not to be ruled by a foreign power or a monarch, but rather for Americans to enjoy the benefits of self-government and freedom.
Hmm. You know, you mentioned that this is our 240th anniversary, and we are the world's longest ongoing republic. Our founding fathers knew the immediate predecessor of the English Republic there in the 1650s. They had seen the rise and fall of monarchies. Do you think our founding fathers believed it would really last this long?
I think that it was a very scary thing for the founding fathers. And really, it came about over a long period of time. You know, after the French and Indian War, the Parliament and found, you know, wanted to find ways to pay for that war. And so this taxation without representation and the whole idea of the stamp tax and all these series of taxes that were levied, really without the consent of the people, that really caused an economic problem for the United States, for our budding kind of foreign trade from the colonies. And so really it was this unfair taxation. And not all Americans believed in the fight for freedom. Only about a third of the Americans who were alive in 1776 were patriots and who fought for their freedom. There were Tories that fought against them, and then there's, you know, about a third of the public who didn't really care. So in some ways, it's a little bit like public life today.
Yeah, I was just thinking that while you're saying that. And, you know, it's not always majority that carries the day, but sometimes it's that persistent minority that really pushes things through.
Yeah, the defeated Tories, a lot of them moved to Canada. And, of course, the conflict wasn't over because in some ways the country refought the revolution in the War of 1812.
That's right. I think one of the things that has made us so successful, especially when you look at back at that the English Revolution, is the notion of the limits on power and our checks and balances. Even though Cromwell is supposedly an elected position, but he had an awful lot of power, and we have a very limited presidency. In fact, as you mentioned, Washington wanted to make sure that that always stayed limited, and so he did not stay on for life, but he just took the two terms. Also, we have congressional terms that they're up for election every 2 years and then also for six for the senators. Talk to us about, especially, though, the importance of the Electoral College.
Well, the whole thing is it's really genius the way that the checks and balances were put together. Having the three branches of government, you know, that can check each other, that can control the power that one branch might have. The idea that we have a House and a Senate in the legislative branch. A president has the ability to veto. All of this came out of history where people, certain parts of society would have too much power. Mm-hmm. So this is a beautifully balanced machine. One of those balances is the Electoral College, and I am a big fan of the Electoral College. We have a very unusual election cycle this year. A lot of people are just kind of scratching their heads and saying, wow, we've never seen an election like this. The founding fathers anticipated this kind of situation and put some brakes on the machine here. You know, the Electoral College brings the question back to the House of Representatives if one candidate doesn't get the 270 votes. And so it could apply this year. It could be the year when people say, yeah, it looks like the Electoral College was a good check and balance that the founding fathers put in place.
Now, didn't that happen one other time in history where it did come down to the House having to make the decision?
I believe it did, but I'm not familiar with it.
Yeah, I'm drawing a blank on that as well. So,
I'm sure it is. But the idea that you would anticipate those kinds of conflicts and find a way to, you know, balance the power structure so that no one group could kind of run away with the entire government, I think was genius and really is a barrier against tyranny.
Yes, and I agree that it was genius. Was there any sort of historical precedent for that, where that dispersion of power?
Yes, I think that all came out of, you know, the discussions that Locke and Montesquieu and, you know, Burke and all the other political philosophers of, you know, the Reformation and in England really had seen those problems over the years with the king. And so being students of what the English did, I think our founding fathers said, if we are to design something new, let's make something which is balanced, where the people actually have a say in the outcome.
But in terms of an actual structure of government set up that way, where there was that balance of power, was there any sort of historical precedent to that?
Well, the House of Lords and the House of Commons in England gives the basic structure for the House and the Senate. But as we know, you know, the House of Lords at that time was not elected. It was really appointed by the king. It was part of the aristocracy.
Right.
So, yeah, there was some rough outlines, but the American experiment was pretty much a new thing and was really there because of the intellect and understanding of power up by the founding fathers.
Hmm. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break there. Coming up, we're going to be talking about one of the first really big celebrations of the 4th of July, the 50th anniversary. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is our annual 4th of July show here on the iSpy Radio Show, and we're talking with Greg Leo. He is a political and business consultant by day, but a historian by night, and he is our go-to guy for this. And 6 years we've been doing this now. Greg, does that seem possible?
It does, but each time there's always something new. You know, the 4th of July is my favorite holiday. It's a great opportunity for Americans and Oregonians to celebrate their freedom.
Yeah, it sure is. So we mentioned in the last segment that we are doing 240 years this year, but in our pre-interview, you mentioned that the 50th anniversary was a really big deal. Why was that so important?
Well, this was really a remarkable time. On the 50th anniversary, they planned a very big event in Philadelphia, and it turns out that Jefferson and Adams died on that very same day. Mm-hmm. The writers who were carrying the news, north from Monticello and south from Boston, met there at Philadelphia where the celebration was occurring. And on the 50th anniversary, for the two people who had really the most to do with the writing of the original document to die on that day, you have to wonder, you have to kind of think of that as divine providence, I think.
Yeah, it is very fascinating to think that they both died on that same day and on July 4th. You know, it's one thing if they die on the same day, period, but for it to fall on the 4th, that really is rather remarkable.
In the famous last words of Thomas Jefferson, you know, does Adams live? You know, because it wasn't just that they were both brilliant and they both played such an important role in writing the document and debating out the whole question of populism versus federalism. But, you know, they were also at various times friends and very tough political adversaries.
Yes.
It's like, you know, the leadership path was brightened from time to time by great adversaries. And Jefferson and Adams give example to us today, I think.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you look at the acrimony that's going on right now on either the Republican side or between Republicans and Democrats, and even on the Democrat side there between Bernie and Hillary. A lot of acrimony. But boy, I tell you, some of it seems to sort of pale in comparison to what happened there between Jefferson and Adams and, when they were both
Jefferson
running for the
Adams
second presidency.
Yeah, they wrote pamphlets and newspapers that were horribly personal,
yes.
Nasty attacks on each other. It really kind of makes today's attack politics look a little pale. And they were really battling for what kind of a government would this be? Would it be populist and broad-based, or would it be centralized and be a federalist government? And so that dialectic really went on down through the years and is in a sense kind of what we're seeing today.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I found to be interesting is about Adams' presidency is that you know, he had been involved so deeply with the crafting of the Constitution and with the Declaration of Independence and so on. And yet when he took office, one of the first things that he did was that the Alien and Sedition Act.
That's right.
Which was just a huge abuse of federal power.
And it was really driven by the foreign affairs and concerns that the British would come back and try to take the colonies back over. And so it was an overreaction, and many will say unconstitutional, and was eventually turned back because of these checks and balances that we have in the system.
And that, I think, is what gives me a lot of hope in today's world, is that, you know, we have weathered 8 years of Obama, and yeah, we've certainly seen a lot of things happen, but we know that that's ending. That is the check and balance there, is that his power is ending. He's going away, and somebody will replace him. Now, of course, who that is going to be interesting. I think if we have Hillary in there, we're going to see 8 more years of Obama, and boy, I tell you, we're on the precipice.
But for the greatest nation in the world, they have bloodless transfers of power is to our credit, and
yes,
really to the credit of the founding fathers. I mean, we may be marching in the streets, but it's with placards rather than guns. And that is so unusual, you know, when you look at regime changes in other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This American system has been a blessing of the Creator, really, for 240 years. And we're just seeing, you know, the latest kind of tussle over who the next president will be. But it's being done with ballots, not bullets. And that's the important thing.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, getting back to the 50th anniversary, what were some of the big things that they were going to do that day?
Well, they were really thinking about Manifest Destiny, and that was, of course, just before, you know, about 10 years before the war with Mexico, and the whole idea of taking America from sea to shining sea. And we see that worked out here in Oregon with the Oregon question. You know, Oregon could have been Russian, it could have been Spanish, it could have been British, in terms of, it could be British Canadian, or it could have been American. And really, it was that migration that started around the mid-1820s, you know, culminating in the vote at Shampooig in 1843, which caused America to have control over the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah, and we'll come back to that in a little bit later segment. But in terms of the actual celebration, was there like a massive parade? I mean, what were some of the things they were looking at?
Yeah, wonderful fireworks display. They had oration. Of course, that was back in the day when you might have a three-hour oration. But Philadelphia was really set up for a party, much like the party that we saw in my lifetime, in 1976 with our 200th anniversary. And so Philadelphia has always kind of been the focal point because that's where this finely tuned machine was written in the hot days of July in 1776.
Yeah, I cannot imagine standing up for a three-hour oration in some of those wool jackets and suit coats that they had. I can't even fathom that.
I'm sure they were fortified by much ale and many fireworks and probably a good barbecue too. And really, not unlike what we do today. It's like when you look back at all these different celebrations, the themes of, you know, family, food, fireworks, oration, enjoyment really follow through, because this really is a celebration of freedom.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the ale. That brings to mind a quote by Ben Franklin that went something like, "Beer is proof that God loves us."
Exactly right. God loves man. That's right. Franklin had some good things to say.
He did. So, all right, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we're going to be talking about some how the 4th of July got us through some dark moments in our history. Stay with us. And welcome back to iSpy Radio Show. This is our annual 4th of July show with Greg Leo. He is a political and business consultant by day, but a historian by night. And Greg, you are definitely not a fly-by-night historian. I always enjoy your insights here. And just to finish up of that last segment, the actual quote from Ben Franklin was, "Beer is proof that God loves us and wants us to be happy." I knew there was a second half to that one. But anyway, speaking of beer and celebrating, let's talk about how the 4th got us through some darker moments in history. And I think one of the ones that springs to mind is the July 4th weekend for 1863, when you had two battles going on, Gettysburg and Vicksburg.
Probably the turning point in the Civil War happened on the 4th of July in 1863. You know, Meade was defending Robert E. Lee's army, having gone north. Their objective was to capture Harrisburg, you know, capital of Pennsylvania, and sue for peace on Southern terms, which meant dividing the country. But Meade brought the army, the Union army, together, you know, at Gettysburg, and after 4 days of fighting, you know, won. And so that was really an important turning point. But at the same time, over on the Mississippi River at Vicksburg, Ulysses Grant defeated that long siege that had been going on at Vicksburg, really splitting the Confederacy along the Mississippi River. Mm-hmm. So really, 4th of July 1863 was the turning point of probably our greatest national crisis.
That really is pretty exciting to think that both of those were going on. And I'm very familiar with Gettysburg. I've been there a couple of times. Great place to take your kids. I've never been to Vicksburg, so I can't really say what that is like there. But with Gettysburg, you get that real deep sense of history. Yeah, I mean, you can just feel history surrounding you there.
That's right. And that really was the high tide of the Confederacy. In fact, there's a place at Gettysburg, the Copse of Trees, where they call it the mm-hmm. high tide of
yes.
the Confederacy. And that's where Pickett's charge, you know, ran into the Union line up there on the ridge. And that really was the turning point in this great constitutional crisis that the country had.
Yes. Yeah, I've stood there at that copse of trees, and there's a low stone wall that the Union soldiers were standing behind, and you look across this huge expanse of field, and you know what the military was like back then. I mean, they were marching across in open fields, no cover whatsoever, into the face of cannons. It's astounding to think anyone could have done that.
No, it took incredible courage. The Virginians that Pickett led, you know, afterwards, Pickett never forgave U.S. Grant. Forgave Robert E. Lee. Longstreet told Lee not to try to make the frontal assault on the ridge, but he did it anyway. And so, really, in that for that generation of Virginians, Many of their people died all across Virginia, and they remember this to this day.
Yeah. Well, it really is.
Another dark spot in our history came in 1876 on the 100th anniversary, and that is Custer decided to go into the Little Bighorn in order to get the headline of his victory on the front page of the paper in Philadelphia. And so one of the reasons why he, in such a reckless way, went into the Little Bighorn Valley and ran into the, you know, combined Indian nations, which led to the Custer's massacre, was because he wanted to be there in the media cycle for the 4th of July's, the 100th anniversary of the Declaration.
It's amazing how things don't change in terms of human nature. And, you know, we were talking about that off air, is that I think is really one of the reasons why the Founding Fathers were so successful in setting up this country was their deep understanding of human nature and this notion that both man and governments want to accumulate power. And here, you know, again, it's human nature that he's trying to get out there and get the fame and whatnot. But we see that with our Founding Fathers and their deep understanding of mankind and our, sad to say, but our worst natures.
And then, you know, another dark time in American history was 4th of July in 1942, where after, you know, America had entered World War II, nothing had gone right. We were losing the Philippines. You know, we were attacked at Pearl Harbor, lost ground in the Pacific. FDR went on the radio with one of his famous fireside chats. This one is 4th of July speech. But he said something really good. I wanted to read this for your audience. He said, "The United States will never survive as a happy and fertile oasis of liberty if we are surrounded by a cruel desert of dictatorship." And with those words, he mobilized America. We fought World War II, and in many ways, I think we saved the world.
That's really interesting. I think going into that, I know that there was a lot of people that were very unsure if we could even defeat Germany and Japan. I mean, these were some of the largest armies on earth. Germany was certainly feared because of their prowess and how easily they had taken over France. And I'm sure that meant a lot to people to hear that. And I think he says it right, is that we would never be able to survive in that kind of desert with all of these despots surrounding us.
That's right. And this idea that we're an oasis of liberty is such a great term, because there are so many other places in the world where the people don't enjoy the freedoms that we have. And, you know, again, this is why we celebrate. But FDR was able to bring together the American people, and America was ready to fight the totalitarian, the tyrants, both in Europe and in Asia.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, going into the World War II, of course, you had the Depression era. What were celebrations like then? I mean, were they scaled down or even canceled, or did they continue anyway?
I don't think the 4th of July is. I remember stories that my parents told me from the Depression. You know, a lot of times they were down on the farm. There would be baseball games. There was always a picnic. Sometimes somebody would play an instrument or would give a speech. But the idea was that was the day you took off the hard work of farming. You got everybody together and you spent some family time to have a celebration, regardless of you had much in the way of material resources. It was really about the people.
Well, and I can certainly see how even just those little celebrations would have meant a lot to people. You know, even if you know, got a sparkler or two, that was certainly a lot better than none at all. And
you know, our traditions give us a way to, you know, cling to some normalcy during times of crisis.
That's right.
In a way, they become more important during the bad times. But through good times and bad, America, that bright light of freedom has shined. And this is why we need to celebrate the 4th of July and honor these traditions that have given us so much.
Well, during World War II, did the troops celebrate 4th of July overseas at all? And because if they did, I can imagine how that would be kind of a beacon of hope to the people of occupied France and so on.
Of course, in 1944, we were in the hedgerows just breaking out, you know, of Normandy, headed towards Paris. You know, in the South Pacific, of course, the island hopping was going on, much loss of American life. You know, back home, people were receiving telegrams of the war. There were great bond drives going on. People were collecting tinfoil and, you know, other metals to be used in the war effort. The country had really come together by 1944, and that's when that great arsenal of democracy created this great military force,
yes,
which beat back Hitler and the Japanese.
Yeah, pretty astounding to think about it. All right, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we're going to be talking about shampooing. Stay with us. It is our 4th of July show with Greg Leo here on the iSpy Radio Show. Greg is a political consultant and business consultant as well, but he is also our in-house historian, I like to think of, when it comes to the 4th of July. And, you know, we were talking in that last segment there about darker moments in history and how our 4th of July celebrations really got us through that. And I think a lot of people sometimes think that we're in a dark time now. And I got to say, I disagree. I think this is an incredible time to be alive. I mean, we may be sitting on the threshold to witness the rebirth of American exceptionalism. I mean, who would not want to be alive in that era?
Well, this is a great time and a great country and a prosperous time, really, and a time when we are generally at peace, although there are international questions. But, you know, the main thing is that America is working.
Yes.
And our system of government, for all of its flaws, is still the best on earth. And the fact that we can celebrate freedom in our own way, worship the way we want to, and enjoy the freedoms outlined in the Bill of Rights is really a testimonial to how well this system works.
Yeah, and absolutely. And I think the 4th of July, to me, that's what it's all about, is celebrating this the notion of American exceptionalism. And I know that Obama doesn't see America as exceptional. I know that he's, you know, been spending 7 years apologizing for America, but America is the best place on earth. Let's face it. And why would you not want to celebrate that? I think that's awesome.
And that's what we do on the 4th. And everybody should do it in their own way. But firing off firecrackers, that's part of the tradition. There's always been bonfires and firecrackers. There's always been barbecues. And frankly, I think there's always been beer.
Yeah.
You know, so those are the things that Americans go to, and if they can think about their country and thank the Creator for their freedoms, that would be good too.
That's right, and that's the important thing too, is to be very thankful, yep, for what we have here in the United States.
That's right.
So, you know, to listeners outside of Oregon, they may not be familiar with shampooing, and sadly enough, there's probably a lot of Oregonians who maybe forgot their history. But why is shampooing famous? What happened there?
Yeah, on May 3rd, 1843, there was a divide where the settlers of the Willamette Valley, and there were about 100 of them at that time, decided that they would be Americans and form a self-government here in the Willamette Valley rather than be British subjects and essentially be Canadians. Now, many of those folks had come here with the Hudson's Bay Company and were French Canadians. So they had a meeting. They started with a couple of wolf meetings to figure out how to deal with wolves and other, you know, predators like panthers and that kind of thing. But they were really talking about government and self-government. The vote, the first vote came down to a dead heat with 50 votes on each side. But then Joe Meek called for a divide. Everybody who wanted to be British on one side of the line, those that wanted to be Americans on the other. And two of the French Canadians came across the line. Francois Matteau and Lucier, Étienne Lucier, came across the line, and they were both French Canadians who had left Quebec because of the British lack of freedom, and so they did not want to live in a new land that was governed by the British and did not have basic freedoms. That's why they crossed over, and that's why Oregonians are Americans and not Canadians today.
Hmm. You know, it's kind of interesting. I was doing some quick research there, and The whole reason that the shampooing meeting started apparently was because of the death of a highly successful pioneer, Ewing Young.
And Ewing Young was an amazing guy. He was a mountain man, a trapper, and he actually trained Kit Carson, which was interesting. But he brought cattle to the Willamette Valley. He drove 400 head of curly horned Spanish cattle up from the Bay Area, which he had gotten from the Spanish. The British would not sell you a cow. They could rent you a cow for milk, but not sell you a cow for meat. Ewing Young saved that by bringing this cattle into Oregon, became the richest man in Oregon, and then died without a will. So the settlers got together, adopted the laws, I believe, of Indiana, and then probated Ewing Young's will.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? we're so lawyered to death nowadays, and here in the founding days of Oregon, there wasn't a probate court. So when he died, he didn't leave a will or an heir.
He didn't have an heir. He didn't have a will. He did actually have an heir, but the heir showed up 15 years later.
Oh,
but,
how funny.
But basically, you have to have a rule of law where when you're the richest man in Oregon and you own, you know, mills and cattle and trading posts, et cetera, you can't just have it up for grabs. There's got to be rules about how that property is distributed. And that's the rule of law that we all live under today.
So in those early days, there were four factions. You had the U.S. and the British, Canadians and the French, the Spanish and the Russian. How many met there, and how were the numbers of representatives decided, and were they and how were they selected to go there?
Yeah, the Oregon question was a huge geopolitical question, almost brought America to war. You can remember 54-40 or fight. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's the Alaskan boundary way north of where we are today. But four nations had a claim to the Pacific Northwest. The Russians had fur trading on our coast. The Spanish in California felt that Oregon was kind of California North and they should have control. The British Hudson's Bay Company had come out, established some settlement in the fur trade, and then we had the migration of Americans, a manifest destiny, if you will, coming across the continent and settling here. So that was, that question was largely settled at Shampui, but there was a treaty. We had to go through a number of very tense political, geopolitical situations between the United States and Britain, which eventually were decided by treaty in, I believe, 1848.
Well, but in terms of the numbers of representatives that, that voted to go with the United States rather than Britain, right, how were those numbers of representatives decided, or was it just whoever showed up?
No, it was people who actually were white men who lived in the Willamette Valley. So if you were Native American, you couldn't vote. You know, if you're a woman, you couldn't vote. But these were all men who had property, and there was 100. There was exactly 100 of them. Hmm. The 52 who voted to become Americans are engraved on the monument at Shampui. The 48 that voted against that are lost to history. Hmm. They didn't even write down the names. So we can't really say who voted against. And the moral to that story is that if you're going to vote on something like that, always be on the winning side.
Yeah, history has a tendency to remember the winners, that's for sure.
Exactly.
All right, let's go ahead.
We're going to celebrate at Shampui this year on the 4th, and all of your listeners are invited.
Yes.
And it's going to be a great program.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what we're going to talk about in the next segment with Greg. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now here on the iSpy Radio Show. It's our annual 4th of July show with Greg Leo. And Greg, during the break there, we were talking about those people that showed up at Shampui to vote. And there was only 100 of them. And I was asking if that was the totality of all of the Willamette Valley settlers. But you said there was actually probably closer to 300.
Well, you know, meetings are decided by the people who show up. And it really 100 showed up. There were about 350 people in the Willamette Valley.
Yeah. Hmm. And what's interesting, like you say, is actually history is decided by those who managed to show up. So if you're thinking of sitting out the election this year, you better not.
You better participate.
Yeah, and like I said, we're on the threshold of witnessing the rebirth of American exceptionalism. So I really hope that people get in there and vote. And so anyway, with our 5 minutes or so left here, we want to talk about the events that are happening this year at Shampui. And every year you guys have a great 4th of July celebration up there. Great place for family, kind of an old time celebration. I've been there once and would like to go again sometime soon. Unfortunately, I just am not able to tear away for family reasons. But for those that can make it, what can they expect this year?
Well, we're going to have a great show this year. It's really a very patriotic event. We read the Declaration of Independence. We're going to have a contest, the Oregon History Bee, and then we're going to have a bit of a show to talk about the Oregon question, how we became Americans and not Canadians. Hmm. And there's going to be two historical reenactors who will actually voice the different points of view. One will give the American settler point of view. The other will talk from kind of the Canadian, British point of view. So this is at 4 p.m. on July 4th at Newell Pioneer Village, which is at Champuy Park.
And so people coming up or down I-5, depending on which way you're coming from, what's the fastest way to get to Champuy then?
Well, best way is to go up I-5 and to take the Aurora Donald exit, which I believe is 248, and then to come over to the west to Champuy Park. At the far west end of the park is Newell, you know, historic Newell Pioneer Village, and that's really run by the Daughters of the American Revolution. So you can go online and look for Newell Pioneer Village at Champuy Park, and you will find this event.
Hmm. And one of the things that, that you do every year that I always think is very moving is the reading of the Declaration of Independence, and you split that up into easily read sections, and you just go around and everybody reads their own. That really is, I think, exceptionally moving, just to hear those words again that gave birth to our nation.
It is moving, and people really love this part of the event. We've taken the Declaration and divided it into 64 pieces, 64 lines. And, you know, certain people want certain lines, but we'll have all sorts of people. We'll have kids and elderly people. Really, everybody in the audience will take a piece of it and read it. It's very stirring and something really good to do on the 4th.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And so many great lines from the Declaration of Independence. And is there a cost for the event?
No, this is a free event. It's sponsored by the Daughters of the American Revolution. They have a mission of teaching patriotism and you know, talk about American heritage. And so this is something we do as volunteers in order to spread the good word about American patriotism.
And what are some of the other elements? You guys have food to eat. It seems like you guys have a pie contest of some sort.
We do. We have a pie contest where we have a panel of experts taste, you know, about a dozen local pies, and then we auction off the pies to support the Newell Pioneer Village. And a lot of times we'll have youth come up and talk about history, about Oregon history and American history. The history bee is the idea of like a spelling bee, but we have questions that, you know, kind of stump the experts about their knowledge of early American history and the Declaration of Independence and early Oregon history.
And prizes for that?
Yes. We give away lots of American flags. The kids will oftentimes get kazoos and other kinds of, you know, musical instruments from America's past.
Something to entertain their parents on the ride home.
Yes, and the parents love it because this is a great opportunity to sit in a folding chair underneath a beautiful tree and be entertained about your nation's history. We do sing songs. We'll sing America the Beautiful, the national anthem, and we'll sing the Oregon State anthem, Oregon, My Oregon.
And you guys will sometimes have historical musicians come up, too. Do you guys have anybody like that this year?
Well, we've had Corral Creek up, which is an excellent bluegrass band, and I believe Corral Creek is coming again. They're a band out of the Newburgh area, and they brighten up the show with their really fun bluegrass music.
Well, it really is a fascinating and fun event, especially if you're a parent and you've got young kids. I really encourage you to go. It's like that old time July 4th celebrations and just really celebrating America and celebrating that Americana and what really brings us together.
Exactly right, and it's at 4 p.m. on July 4th. We invite everybody who hears this to come to it. If you want more information online, it's Newell. N-E-W-E-L-L, Pioneer Village.
Okay, great. Greg, I want to thank you so much for your time, and happy 4th of July.
Well, thank you. We're going to celebrate freedom and remember all those good things about America.
All right, sounds good. That address one more time is newellpioneervillage.com, and Newell is N-E-W-E-L-L. We certainly hope that you enjoyed today's show. It's been a good time of late for America and for independence. Some of Obama's overreach of power have gone down thanks to that whole checks and balances thing. Britain votes for independence, and as I said, we stand on the threshold of restoring American exceptionalism. What a great time to be alive. That's all our time for today. We wish you a fantastic and safe 4th of July. Remember that freedom is never more than one generation from extinction. We must fight for it, protect it, and hand it on to the next generation.
Or as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.